I want to introduce our guest moderator, none other than the guy who gives it, I was going to say his head, but no. Everybody wants head, Al Snow. Give it up for Al.
You
good? How are you?
You guys have been a great WrestleMania weekend already.
Is it WrestleMania?
Yeah. It is.
I thought it was WrestleCon.
Nah, it's a bigger event. WrestleMania. It's kind of a.
What can do?
It'll be on Sunday.
Yeah, but the real stars are here today.
So. That's true. The real stars are here.
Yeah, they are.
That's what I think.
Yeah.
So you guys excited about the debate and the questions?
Yes.
Does everybody have any good questions already?
No.
You guys have no good questions. What you're attending, what you could possibly find out, and from who? Well, let me introduce first the Vice President of Talent Relations for TNA. He was in charge of Talent Relations for WWE. He was Vince's right-hand man for many, many years, Bruce Pritchard. And then Eric Bischoff, the head of WCW.
It's not the same about the NWO music as you walk in. Hum it.
Oh, who is this?
Got it on your phone, couldn't you?
Okay, so I would assume you guys are all very interested in what happened years ago in the Monday Night Wars and what took place behind the scenes. So here is your opportunity to delve in and find out all we can.
And since this is Al's first time doing this, just to kind of give you guys a little bit of a history lesson and how this even came about. Eric and I, you know, we're actually friends, real life. But when we would go out, we'd have a few adult beverages, which, oh, God bless you. It would kind of start like this.
Oh, where'd those come from? Oh, my God.
Hell of a night, Eric.
Hell of a night.
So we would start like this. It'd be all nice, smiley, cordial, fun, back and forth, and so on and so forth. And we would reach the point where everybody has them, where we would start talking about business and kind of the old days. Well, in the old days, back in the Monday Night War days, Eric was on one side over there at the Ted Turner's WCW, and I was up the WWF with Vince McMahon. And we would start discussing things, and Eric would have his viewpoint, not necessarily the right viewpoint, but he had his viewpoint, I had my viewpoint. It would get, you know, somewhat exaggerated, and we would see things from a very, very different light. And the conversations got a little more colorful as it went on. And Eric has this crazy idea, says, hey, we ought to take this out on the road and kind of share this and share it with those that have questions of things that you might have seen that it happened from an outsider's view looking in and say, hey, what really did happen at such and such a time? And we got our first one out in Philadelphia, went well, and we're doing our next one here. So feel free to, you know, Al's going to kind of moderate this thing and lead us along that path. So feel free to ask questions. Every show is different, so you guys kind of dictate where we're going to go and what you want to know.
And just to add briefly to that, don't be afraid to ask hard questions because that's what makes it fun for us. You know, we're close enough friends that we can be honest, and we already know that we have different opinions about things. But what makes this kind of thing fun is when you ask the really, really tough questions. So even though we're laughing and we're joking and we're having a great time, don't be afraid to ask the tough ones, okay?
Good. Well, why don't we start at the beginning? I mean, what kicked off the war between WWE and WCW?
He did it.
Kind of, sort of. You know, if you look at the history of WWE, WWF, WWE, way back. You know, in the beginning, it was, you know, the business was a territory business. And Vince McMahon in the 80s, and I don't remember what part of the 80s, but it was in the mid-80s, decided that, you know, the territory system is over. He's going to take over the country. And then he went, and in his own way, some of it very aggressive, some of it cooperative, kind of aggregated the territory system and launched on cable and became this huge juggernaut. Well, in the late 80s, about 88, 89, Ted Turner, who had been licensing NWA programming from the Crockett's, decided, well, I don't want to rent a program anymore. I want to own my own wrestling company. And that was Ted's MO. I mean, he did it with everything. That's how CNN came to be. That's why he bought the MGM movie library. That's why he bought New Line Cinema. He didn't want to rent other people's product. He wanted to own it for his networks. So Ted decided that he wanted to become a big company and he wanted to compete on a national level. And, you know, I'm fast-forwarding here, but it was really Ted's desire way back in the 80s to own his content, own his own properties, not license anybody else's. It was really the beginning of it, to be honest.
Well, just since we're going to have a history lesson, you know, back, and a lot of people think, you know, there's a lot of different viewpoints on what Vince did. You know, this old man, he inherited the business. Vince didn't inherit the business. Vince bought the business from his father and his partners. And when Vince went out to go and some say consume the territories, Vince went to every one of those promoters, offered to buy him out. Made the same offer to them, offered to work with them, buy them out, let them be a part of the WWF at the time. Everyone, with the exception of Michael Bell, I believe, out in Los Angeles, told him to fuck himself. Everyone said, I'll destroy you, I'll crush you, you'll never come into my town, and we'll destroy you. And he did. And instead of worrying about their own business, they were worried about what Vince was doing, which then consumed their own businesses, and Vince overtook them. And
okay, and then
Eric came along.
No. Now we're skipping over a really important piece of this equation. Yes, that is true. And I actually heard it from Vern Gagne when I first started to work for AWA. Vern told me about the time when Vince came in and offered to buy him out. And Vince, even back in 87, Vern, even back in 87, 88, even as late as 89, was kind of part of the fact that he told Vince to go fuck himself. But here's the other part that Vince did. He stole their talent. He did the same freaking thing that he cried and whined and wimped about big bad Ted Turner, the billionaire, stealing all of his talent. That's exactly what he did in order to take himself to that level. So yes, he offered him a deal. And if they bought, he stole the freaking talent.
It's not true, because the talent wasn't under contract for the most part.
And neither was Kevin Nash or Scott Hall or anybody else that came
to
the
table. They were negotiating.
They
were.
Yeah.
They
were.
So that was a big difference. Vince went and cherry-picked the talent that he wanted and made them an offer.
Stole them. According to his own definition, he stole. He can't equivocate. I'm going to call
business.
Go ahead.
I have to agree with Eric. If it had not been for Vince going and taking all of that talent,
giving them an opportunity.
I didn't know you drank a bunch of Kool-Aid before you came here.
So then you fast forward. Ted Turner wants to buy his own wrestling company, and Ted has his company, and you get into and come along September 11th, some time in 1990 something or other. I'm going to let Eric tell this story, because that's when Ted Turner, who owned TNT Network, he owned several of his own television stations, channels, what have you. He controlled all the content, owned the content. WWF, on the other hand, was on the USA Network.
Okay, we couldn't dictate what time or what day that we were on the air and what have you. So I'll let Eric tell you about the story when Ted Turner came to him and said, what's going on with this and why is WWF the number one show on cable week after week after week?
So here's why I like to do this thing. Because you all watch the news, right? I mean, raise your hands if you're a fan of MSNBC. Thank God.
You're the one.
Sonny, really? Really?
I don't watch Fox.
Oh.
I don't. I watch Fox.
I'm a Fox guy. I'm a conservative. All right? And one of the things that I've learned in watching conservative news and information is that you understand how people manipulate the narrative. They change the framing of the discussion to fit the point that they want to make. So while we talk about, you know, Vince McMahon, and I respect Vince McMahon, WWE. I mean, honest to God, I wish I had a fraction of the success that he's had. I look up to him in many, many ways. That notwithstanding, how he got there was pretty aggressive, pretty devastating for a lot of people along the way. So the idea that Big Bad Ted Turner, who owned his own networks, had this unique advantage is true. There's no denying that. But neither can you deny the fact that Vince McMahon, and although he bought, I agree with Bruce on that, he bought his way into the business that his father and his grandfather and probably his great-grandfather had established. He nonetheless bought a very established brand that was based in the northeast part of the United States. It was the densest part of the population and had the strongest TV. He had a unique advantage. Ted Turner bought a broken freaking company in the NWA that was bankrupt. And yes, he wanted to make it something bigger than it was, but he was starting from ground zero, whereas Vince McMahon had three generations of brand legacy to build off of. So it's not quite the uneven playing field that some people who want to point to Ted Turner's advantage of having a network would like you to believe. That being said, yes, Ted did come to me, well, I came to Ted actually. Did you want to say something?
Yeah, Logan Al over here. True.
Bullshit. Ted Turner has the NWA with more of a legacy than the WWF.
Stop, bro.
And then he decided, well, I don't want the NWA anymore. I want world championship. I want world champ. I want world championship wrestling.
First of all,
so he had the Southern accent.
You're
from
Texas.
I'm from Texas, and I'm making fun of Southern accents. But I mean, he had a legacy. He could have. He wanted to create.
But it was a broken legacy. What's the legacy of the
NWA?
Whose fault
was that?
It wasn't Ted's. It wasn't mine. It wasn't anybody else's. It was the Crockett's. It was the people that were involved in NWA. It was no different than buying right now the ABC wrestling territory when it was bankrupt, defunct, screwed up. Ted bought it like a lot of people do. They buy companies, they rehab them, they rebuild them, and they relaunch them, and that's what Ted did.
So what was the first shot fired?
The first
shot started, and why and where did we go?
That's and thanks for that, keeping us on track. We did. Ted did. And it was in a meeting, and I've told the story before, and I'll keep it short. But when I became the executive, I became the executive producer on the heels of the Bill Watts disaster. And maybe you remember that, maybe you don't. Maybe you know about it, maybe you don't. But let me just tell you, it was a freaking disaster of a magnitude that I can't really explain here. Bill Watts did, said, and accomplished things that were so negative that it's hard to explain. And it was at a time when the Turner Executive Committee, now granted, Ted Turner was Ted Turner. He owned the company, and it was still a public company, but he was still the chairman. He had a lot of influence. But there was a certain point where there's an executive committee underneath Ted Turner that also had a lot of influence. And that executive committee was like, they had it with WCW. The bullshit that happened, you know, Jim Herd, Kip Fry, and Bill Watts put it over the top.
And what exactly was that?
It was racial. He said some stupid shit. that today would get you hung on a street corner, and Bill just didn't know any better. He just said some horrible stuff that embarrassed everybody within the Trimmer organization, including, by the way, Hank Aaron and some very important people. And Ted Turner is a very progressive guy. He pulled the plug. And that was the point where within the Turner executive community and the committee in particular, where they said, look, we're going to give this one more run because it's a 10th thing, but if we can't turn this thing around, it's gone. That's what I inherited. I inherited a company that was generating $25 million a year and losing $10 million a year in a process, and nobody in the Turner organization wanted it to be there. That was my take. So when I went to Ted Turner, after having worked and trying to get it to the point where it was marginally profitable, or at least someone would believe that it could be, I had a deal on the table from Rupert Murdoch. Rupert Murdoch, who owned Fox, and Ted Turner, at that time, not anymore, but at that time, were mortal enemies. And I knew that the only way that I could close that deal was to go and ask for permission. Because if I would have closed that deal without Ted's permission, I would have been fired before my breakfast was cold the next day. So I went to Ted with the intent of trying to get him to allow me to do a deal that would put WCW into profit for the very first time. I got about 7 seconds into the conversation, and Ted said, and I won't try to do a Ted impersonation, but it was basically, Eric, what do we got to do to compete with WWF at the time? And I wasn't prepared. I was prepared for every other question, but I wasn't prepared for that one. And I just came up with the only thing I could come up with. I said, well, they're in prime time, and we're at 6 o'clock Saturday, East Coast, 3 o'clock West Coast. We need to be on prime time. I didn't know what else to say. He caught me flat-footed. About a minute later, he said, Scott Sasson, he's a head of all the networks. He said, what's up, Scott? Give her 2 hours every Monday night on TNT. The hell? I just want to sell shit in China. I don't want to be on prime time on Monday night. I just want to sell my shit in China, for God's sake. Leave me alone.
Which you could have had any night of the week. The fact that he wanted to go head up with WWF was
ballsy.
It was ballsy. I give him that ballsy. So to go head up, they waited until we were preempted for 2 weeks in USA because of the Westminster Dog Show to debut their new Nitro show.
Yeah.
And how did it go at first when you first took that foray into Monday night for WCW?
Actually, we did better than we thought we would, I think. And I'm trying to remember back as you're asking that question. We had no expectations because we didn't know what to expect. We hoped we would do well. Deep down inside, if I was going to be really honest about it, I was probably expecting the worst because the odds were stacked so much against us, aside from the fact that we were preempted for a freaking dog show. It says a lot about what USA thought about the property at the time, but whatever. Honestly, that was a joke. But honestly, I kind of felt like we were going to get crushed. It was an uphill battle. I knew that if we didn't make it work, my job was probably on the line. The company was on the line. I knew that. So expectations were pretty low. So when we came back and we got a decent rating, holy shit, there's hope. There's light at the end of the tunnel. That was probably what I felt more than anything. There was light at the end of the tunnel.
But you didn't really hit a major stride for quite some time, did you? During that period, I mean, it was a year or two where both programs were on Monday night, and WWE or WWF at the time was outpacing ratings wise WCW.
They did, but the fact that we were within striking distance was shocking. And then
that was with stealing our talent, Lex Luger.
Stealing. See how they.
I was using your word.
That's actually. prior to before your school?
No, it was the very first Nitro. We're sitting there. I'm in Hong Kong, and you're watching Nitro. You're looking for Raw, and you're going, oh, shit, there's dogs on that show. And you keep clicking the clicker. And oh, my God, there's Lex Luger. He was on Raw last week.
How is that stealing? When you let somebody, here, I'm going to put these glasses up for sale for 2 cents. If someone comes along and buys them for 2 cents, how the fuck is that stealing? No, seriously, we didn't steal anything. But what we did do is, look, our backs were against the wall. We knew we had to make noise. We knew we had to be controversial because even though the book came out a lot later, I knew that we had to create buzz within the industry. And we did things. Look, we couldn't, and this is one of the things, when Ted said, oh, Eric, you know, I go to 2 hours every night on TNT, and I left the office, you know, and my head was spinning, and I was having a mini seizure. And I worked out and went, okay, now what the hell do I do? But here's what I did. I went and sat in my room, in my office, by myself, and I made a list of all the things that the WWF did really well. So, okay, I can't compete with that. There's no way I can compete with this. But here's what they don't do so well. I can do this. So I'm just going to be different. I can't be better than them at what they do, but I can be different than them. And hopefully the viewers will like that. So I just made a list of every way I can be different. And I started out with the very obvious shit. They're tape. We're live. They're kind of kitty, cartoonish, animated. And I say that sounds derisive, and I don't mean it to. But they were very animated, you know, highly characterized.
Family-oriented.
Yeah. I said, okay, I can't do that. I can't be better at what they do than they are. But I'm just going to be more reality-based. I'm going to let guys use your own name. I'm going to do all the things that, you know, we ended up doing. So I just made that list, and that's how we approached it. And it took time, to your point, but the numbers every week, even though they were preempted, and we knew we were taking advantage of that situation, but even when they came back on the air, there wasn't that much daylight between us.
So what was the attitude in Vince's inner circle, Bruce, when Nitro debuted and started?
We're real happy about it. I think that, honestly, had they been on any other night of the week, I don't think that they really wouldn't
be about somebody competing against you.
No, it's like they had their Saturday night show, which did very well in its time slot and do what they were doing. But going head up against what had become the main show for WWF at the time, well, that was war. That was, okay, you want to play? Let's play. So it wasn't one of, you know, joy, joy. We were happy that we were competing. We were happy that we were continually, you know, winning in the ratings. And then, you know, they started.
You were happy as long as you continued to win.
As long as we continued. You're right, yes. But then they started to do what I just did. Okay? They started overpaying talent, like I paid 98 cents more than the offer. Okay? They started offering talent these lucrative contracts that, and at the WWF, your contract was basically opportunity. You have 20. The only guarantee in the contract was $25 to work for television.
Actually, it was $100 when you got 12 dates.
Who the hell thought that was a great opportunity? By the way, that sounds like indentured servitude. Yeah. But that's just me.
Okay, but all of a sudden, you know, there are these guaranteed contracts. Whether you work or not, you get paid. Okay? And you got paid a lot.
But here's the bigger thing. Whether you drew or not.
Whether you drew or not, that's true. And you didn't necessarily have to go out and make live events. They weren't doing a lot of live events at WCW. They were paying big money, okay, for television stars. But they weren't, you know, I dare say that the talent wasn't earning that money. They weren't drawing that money to pay for themselves. You had Ted Turner's checkbook that was paying for that. whether they earned it or not.
Slightly different point of view on that. First of all, the WWE to this day, although it's been changed and modified, thank you very much, at that time they didn't offer guaranteed contracts at all, and they didn't have to, because if you rose to the top of the card or the middle of the card, then you shared in a pool of revenue. It's kind of like communism in a way, where if you're part of the family and the farm and the crops really grow and you can sell them, then you all get to share in that revenue. So it's not a new concept, all right? But the WWE had a distinct advantage in that because it was a 30-year-old company that had a mature licensing, merchandising, and pay-per-view model, it provided a platform or a formula that made sense, so that if Al Snow or Eric Bischoff or Bruce Prichard or any one of you were to come to work for WWF at the time, and you signed on the dotted line, and Vince said, "Well, I'm going to give you an opportunity," and you just sign on the dotted line, and if you get over, then you make a lot of money. Well, there were very good examples of people like Hulk Hogan and Andre the Giant and all the superstars that came before them that did make a ton of money. And it was a unique advantage that Vince had, because he had that mature business model that provided a profit-sharing pool opportunity. Whereas WCW didn't have that. If I would have said to Al Snow back in 1994, "Hey, I'll come to work for WCW and we're going to give you 25% of our pay-per-view revenue."
1994, I don't know.
Guess how much that would have been?
Zip.
So, yes, we did. We were forced. I don't want to say forced, like we had a gun to our head. But our strategy was, yes, we can't compete with the profit-sharing model because we haven't been around for 30-some-odd years. But what we'll do is we'll offer them, and you know, the narrative that we're going to continue to go back to in this discussion was that, "Oh, we signed these huge checks." That's bullshit. I got Randy Savage for less money than Randy Savage was being paid by WWE. All right, I got Hulk Hogan. Yeah, we bent over a little bit for Hulk Hogan. We paid a lot of money for Hulk Hogan. There were people that came on board, Scott Hall, Kevin Nash, and others. They came on board for a decent amount of money at that time. But it wasn't much more than they were making in the profit-sharing pool at WWE. It's just that our way of paying them was different. We guaranteed it because we couldn't profit-share it. WWE could profit-share it. But the narrative is that, "Oh, we only got what we got, and we stole their talent because we wrote these huge checks." Kind of bullshit. Kind of bullshit.
But true.
It's kind of true on a couple of cases.
Okay, you know, I rest my case. But the again, they had the wherewithal to be able to guarantee talent that money, because they did have Ted Turner behind them. They did it.
So was that a freaking sin? The fact that you have the ability to compete, where all of a sudden is that, you know, a bad thing? You get to compete.
Which part?
The part where we had the Ted Turner organization had the money.
Because
why
you had an open checkbook and you were overpaying for talent. And
what's overpaying?
What they're bringing to the table.
What
did they draw in houses?
Yeah, fuck yeah. We got in Georgia for crying out loud. Yeah, we did, actually. We drew ad revenue. We went from $20 million a year in revenue to $350 million a year in revenue. Yeah, I'd say we draw money.
How much you got?
Not a first job. Not at first. And there was just, it was a pattern, and it was probably, I think everyone would agree, it was for the wrestling business itself, it was the best time for the fan, because we were fighting for our lives, okay, and our business wasn't, you know, it wasn't going up, it was kind of staying where it was, because all of a sudden you got something else, and every week you turn on and it became the, "Well, let's go over and see what WCW is doing, and who the hell is going to show up this week?"
Did you think that, from a fan attitude, maybe I'm wrong, that at that point in time, the WWE product would become stale?
Without doubt. I think we've become stagnant, and I think that it was more of a fighting to hang on and hold on to what we did have and hold on to that place, and by God, we can't slip, because we were still number one. We were still number one. So you're just fighting to hold on instead of we became guilty of doing what everybody else had done. We started worrying about, okay, well, what the hell are they doing now? Instead of fortifying what we had and what we had always done to grow the business, we're like, well, shit, what are they doing over there? Who's going next? You become paranoid within your own world as to, okay, well, who's getting the phone calls? Who's getting the offer? What are they paying? What are they doing?
What steps did you guys take to try to mitigate that?
Immediately, you know, when everything first started, we really didn't do anything. We didn't start going in and we...
Why is that?
Didn't have the money. We didn't have the wherewithal to just...
You didn't have to?
No, we didn't have a wherewithal. We didn't have it. It was all a privately held company. All that money was coming out of Vince's back pocket. And we couldn't say, hey, we're going to sign you for 3 years or 2 years at $250,000 a year. Couldn't guarantee it. And Vince wouldn't do it. And, I'll go back just to kind of give you of his mindset. When you guys remember when Vince went through the steroid trial and all that crap? Well, during that time, he refused to sign any talent whatsoever to the company. He goes, I can't look a guy in the eye and tell him we're going to be here in 2 years. He goes, I don't know if I'm going to be here. He goes, I believe I'm going to be here, and I believe the company's going to be here forever. But I can't guarantee it, because when they look at me and go, where are you going to be, Vince? Couldn't answer that question. So there was a couple of years there, and it was like the WrestleMania 11 time. I remember Bam Bam was being one of them. But we couldn't guarantee that money. So that was the difference. There was nothing behind it that would guarantee that 2 years of those heavy contracts.
But that's changed. And when did it change, and who did it change with?
Changed me, actually. But what changed was...
Huh? Which was the first talent to be the first one to get some kind of guarantee?
The real one?
The real one.
That's debatable. It's
going to
be
fucking debate.
Yeah. it's one of three people. Okay? Vader.
Vader,
Warrior.
Oh!
I'm telling you, it was Vader, Merrill, or
Merrill.
No, it wasn't.
Guess what?
It was either Vader or Warrior before that.
It was
they were here before Merrill.
Merrill was the first guy,
no, sir,
who was guaranteed any kind of money from Vince McMahon.
No, actually, then it was Vader. Thank you for answering my question. Right. Because Merrill and Warrior came back in WrestleMania.
Right.
So it was Vader.
All right, I got to jump in here. Because, oftentimes in this kind of discussion, my judgment is questioned in terms of what I offered certain people. We just went on record as saying the very first people that were offered guaranteed money was fucking Mark Merrill and Vader.
Merrill, hang on. I can say
Jerry Jones
without a doubt, Merrill was the third one. Merrill gets credited because everybody went, Mark Merrill? You fucking ribbing me? But that was timing. It was when we were getting ready to offer everybody guaranteed contracts. But of the first, it had to be Vader. Because then Warrior came in at WrestleMania, and also Merrill came in at WrestleMania. So that would be the order.
Really?
I promise.
Why was Vader offered a guaranteed contract? What gave him the negotiating power to be able to be guaranteed in a company that historically, in a business historically,
I think only Vince can answer that one. Yeah, Vince is the only one that really can answer that one. He was hot for Vader at the time. It was It was one of those deals. Vader had Japan and
you
Vader
had
Japan.
You write this down and tweet this shit.
Hashtag.
Tweet
this. For
this
Vader.
This man thought Vader was worth a guaranteed contract.
Yeah, but our guarantees weren't like Ted's guarantees. They were a whole lot different. How they were different was they were downside guarantees. Okay, what that means is you could go to work for Eric, and you could get $250,000 guaranteed, whether you work or not. What we did is we said, okay, we give you like a $200,000 downside guarantee. You'd still be paid on whatever you earned and part of the pools that Eric explained before, but the least amount of money you're going to make is that $200,000, and then whatever you made above that. That was your crane, but you would still be paid exactly as what you earned. That's your downside. Your minimum would be that downside guarantee.
They're not formula, it's still in effect.
Yeah. Exactly.
And everyone that has one can thank me for it. eBishop, hashtag eBishop on Twitter. I did that.
That is true. You did.
That is true. No, he forced us to do it because, you know, talent's coming back to us saying, hey, I know what I'm going to make there. I can't go with your contract and go to a bank to buy a $500,000 house and say, well, I've got a lot of opportunity here. Look, I make $100 for TV. You know, nobody in their right mind is going to look at that and go, yeah, right, I don't care. So we put some meat into it and did the downside guarantees, but still allowed them an upside. So they weren't just, this is just what you're going to make and we can work them together.
And with all due respect, that formula that they came up with then and they've refined since then, I couldn't have pulled it off at that time because, again, I didn't have the pool of revenue to share against a downside guarantee. But the model is a great model in the wrestling business. It's a great model. It wouldn't work in any other business. It wouldn't work in the music business. It wouldn't work in the world of acting, any other form of entertainment. It wouldn't work in sports. It wouldn't work anywhere else, but it works in the WWE, and I've been able to build a tremendous business based on that model alone. So it's
why do you think that it works just for WWE, but not for business?
Because wrestlers don't have any other options. When there's only one place to work and there's only one formula to sign up for, you're going to sign up for that formula.
They had options. They had an option as you. They could.
No, but a lot of them didn't.
Why would they not go to you and stay?
I'll tell you why. They would not. Because it was Vince did have a proven track record of taking care of guys. Vince did have a proven track record of taking care of talent. If the money was there, he paid. I mean, he did take good care of guys. And to give you an example, and whether all of it's true or not, hey, you get to keep 98 cents. Keep the change. A perfect example, The Rock. Okay? He was in the Nation of Domination. He was starting to take off. Hadn't taken off yet. Went in and said, hey, here's your contract. Sealed. And he says, what's it for? I told him what it was for. Not a lot of money. Wasn't Mark Merrill money. And he looked at me and he says, I got Eric Bischoff offering me double whatever you guys can offer me. Eric says he never had a conversation with The Rock. I don't know, they could have been blaming me. Doesn't really matter for the story. I said, well, you know what? That's the most we can guarantee you right now. He says, will you guarantee me one other thing? If I make more, am I going to get paid more? Than having you always. There's a got a notary here. So take it to your lawyer, take it to your wife. His wife was his basically manager, financial consultant. She's a freaking genius, one of the smartest people I've ever met in my life. I said, let Danny take a look at it and be back next week. Just don't need to. As long as Ben says he's gonna take care of me. Signed it that day. That's why I think it worked, because the guys had that kind of confidence in Vince based on past performance that if it was there, he would take care of it. He's always taking care of talent. He's always very, very fair, very good with talent. For the most part.
Not according to most of the talent that left there to come to me. But joking aside, in entertainment in this venue aside, Vince has, I think to this day, there are people that will take a bullet for Vince McMahon. Just, they've developed that relationship. And he's a charismatic. He will, and I believe if, you know, Bruce or I were to call Vince McMahon or Al at this moment, say, look, this is a tough situation. I need this. It may be uncomfortable, but he takes care of his own. He's always had that reputation, which gave him a certain advantage with guys like Rocky, who by the way, his father worked for Vince McMahon. There was a history and a legacy,
grandfather,
relationship. And that was a distinct advantage, so that certain people would go, you know what, Vince took care of my dad or my friend or other people that I'm, you know, familiar with, so I believe he'll take care of me. And by the way, he's a charismatic son of a bitch. He can be one of the hardest, coldest. People talk about me being intense and a dick.
Yeah, they do.
Come on now. Vince McMahon makes me look like Mother Frickin' Teresa. Come on.
Nobody makes you look like Mother Teresa.
Nobody's got to be close.
Nah.
I mean, he can be a scary, intense, demanding son of a bitch. But he's also one of the kindest, caring people that I've really worked with in the business.
Yeah.
You won't see it, but that he used that to his advantage to get people like Rocky and other people to go, you know what, Vince says it's going to be true, it's going to be true. And that was part of the pitch.
The joke was, you used to have talent that would line up outside of Vince's door. They'd have a problem. And while they're on the outside and guys walking by and I'm going to fucking quit. That son of a bitch, I've had it with him. You know, I'm done. This is it. I'm going to tell him this. I'm going to tell that. Blah, 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 blah. And by the time they get there, they get to the door and they're all fucking ready. And they go inside with Vince. 10, 15, 20 minutes later, they walk out. That was the best meeting I ever had in my life. Nothing had happened.
That's true.
He just, everything's going to be okay. You're going to take care of this guy, blah, 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 blah. And they would walk out. Just, and I said, did he get fixed? I have to bring it up. You know, I mean, he would have that way that would have people walking out thinking like they just got $1 million.
And here's, I'm gonna add to this. This is not controversial. It's not a debate. But just to support what Bruce is saying, and I'm skipping ahead, and I apologize for that. But I've had a couple beers, and I'm going to do it anyway. When, after I had, you know, the WCW thing, you know, I went through all that, and it left some scar tissue. I'm not going to lie about it. I had made up my mind. I never want to get near the wrestling business again. I'm done with it. I, you know, made my money, blah, 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 blah. I started my own production company. That was successful. I didn't have no desire to be in the wrestling business again. I get a phone call from Vince McMahon. I don't know what year was that, 2002, 2003, whatever year it was. I can't remember.
Yeah.
To whatever year.
Oh, 102.
And I remember where I was, and the phone rang, and it was Vince McMahon. And he said, oh, well. And I instantly knew who it was on the end of the phone. And within about, I don't know, it might have lasted 4 minutes, I had already agreed to come to WWE. I didn't even ask about money. I forgot to even ask what I was going to be doing. I had no idea what it was I was going there to do, but I said, fuck it. Yeah. Sounds good. What's the worst that can happen? That's how convincing and charismatic he was when it came to getting people to sign up for these opportunity deals.
Yeah, then when it came time to tell him what they're really going to do, I got that job. And then, what? Yeah, so it was a little different. Guys, come on, questions. You guys have anything? Anything you want to get in? I'll let Alan get out there to you. And get involved. Have some fun.
I mean, we're here.
You're here.
I have more questions too.
On the West Coast, we got Nitro at 6 o'clock. Did that affect your ratings at all?
that was a huge disadvantage that we had that USA and WWE didn't have, because they had a simultaneous feed. So they were at 8 o'clock, whatever time it was, on Monday night across the country at that time. Good question, by the way. Thank you for asking it.
But you had a replay.
We didn't have the simultaneous feed. Replays not the same thing. And
it played at the same time as we did.
But it wasn't live. There's a difference.
There is a difference.
There is a difference. Fleas having sex would draw money. Okay, live. Fleas having sex 2 hours after it was over, not so much. So we had that challenge, but that was a challenge. In the beginning, Turner later switched over to a simultaneous feed, and then we overcame that.
Okay,
thank you. Great question.
Thank
you for asking.
You guys, you got on Monday night. You know you're watching the camera. Okay. The competition started.
Massive show
between WWE and WCW, or WWF at the time. You were staying on Monday night and staying within arm's reach, according to you, according to everyone in the locker room in WWF. It was, we beat them again.
Because we did.
Correct. What was the moment, what was the pivotal moment that put you from beyond just arm's reach to where you could actually be in a position to overtake them? Because there was a one particular moment.
Great question, by the way. And it wasn't one thing. It was a combination of things and indicators. And I've always, even now, and I have a great partner by the name of Jason Hervey, who's obviously down here right now, and we produce television shows, and we're competing out there with reality, and we do a little bit of sitcom stuff. And here's the truth. The truth is there's never one thing that tells you anything. But there's little tiny indicators all the way around everything that you do that give you support in your decisions. And what gave us support and let us know that we were on the right track is we went to the Mall of America. By the way, we went to the Mall of America because we knew we couldn't draw a crowd. WCW couldn't draw flies if they rode themselves in cow shit. Couldn't. So we said, okay, if we're going to launch the show called Nitro, and it's going to be live, and it's going to be this huge thing on prime time, we've got to make it look cool. Well, how do we do that? So we went to the Mall of America, because there was no other options. And then every week afterwards, we would go somewhere, and the crowds got a little bigger, and a little bigger, and a little bigger, and more vocal, and more vocal, and more vocal, and all of a sudden we realized it. We just don't think we have a good idea. They're showing us we have a good idea.
When was the first Clash of Champions?
Stumped. I don't know.
Do you know, Bruce?
The first Clash of Champions was WrestleMania 1988.
A lot of us, would you agree that we all believe that was probably the point that helped put WCW in? Because it helped. You get offered a show on the very day that WWF was offering the show today to see for free.
Well, that's a good point. I've never thought about that.
But didn't Vince like try to block it, say, if you covered, if you carried this show, we're not going to let you have whatever the next thing
that was next year.
Interview was?
That was your point.
You know, the legend is, we had an event called the Survivor Series that was going to be on pay-per-view, and Jim Crockett, back in the day, decided he wanted to run Thanksgiving on pay-per-view, and he was like, okay, pick them, boys. If you want WrestleMania, you need to pick up Survivor Series. And he picked up Jim Crockett. WrestleMania.
So don't you think that's unfair competition? Is that restraint of trade of monopolistic tendencies?
No.
Of course not.
No.
Just like stealing like, talent, forcing distributors, pick us, pick the other.
Oh.
That's all fair, right? But what we did was...
No, we gave them the choice.
Their choice. It's America.
It's like I gave Scott Hall and Kevin Nash and everybody else, right?
That could be called tampering.
So now, when that first show aired, what was the feeling within WCW, and then what was the feeling within WWF?
What first show?
That the first Nitro in the Mall of America.
Well, again, we were preempted, so you know they chose.
That's not what I asked. I didn't ask you what to ask. What was the feeling? What was the attitude?
Good
what
job,
was,
yeah.
What was the consensus? Was Vince upset? Was he happy? Yay! Way to go, fucking guys in WCW.
He was on the roof at Titan Tower shooting an opening for Monday Night Raw. I was in Hong Kong, so I mean, it wasn't jubilation.
Did you dismiss it, or did you take it as a serious shot fired?
No, we did dismiss it. Definitely did dismiss it because you know TNT and USA, they you know they're pretty much equal. So it was gonna keep an eye on this, but it was more pissed than worried.
Pissed in what way? Pissed in like they had the audacity to compete?
How dare they? We had Monday night. They could run in. We didn't go. It's 6:35 or 6:05 on Saturday night. We chose Monday night. Let them have 6:05 to 8:05 on Saturday night.
And what was the attitude within WCW? Not just in the upper yourself, but all the way down, because that trickles all the way down through the entire night.
It's a good question. And there was a definite point of demarcation, meaning at my level, me personally, probably Ted Turner, Scott Sasso, who was the head of the networks at the time, Brad Siegel, who was the president of TNT, was like, yeah, hell yeah, this is good. There's hope. But the talent, because they knew. And it's just inherent in the industry. At that time, there were two places to work. You're either going to get a guaranteed contract from WCW, or you're going to get a chance at the big show. Paul Wade not included. You're going to get a shot at the big shot at WWE. But nobody, the talent was really nervous about being associated with someone that was going to stick it up Vince's ass the way I was sticking it up his ass. It wasn't that comfortable for a lot of the talent. They were happy to be on the team. They were happy to be a part of something that was like, holy cow, this could work. But they also were pretty well aware that, God, I'm on the team that's trying to pull the legs out from the other team. And there was some concern.
Anybody else have another question? Come on up. Come on up. But I got to be careful I don't block the camera.
Certainly you do.
It's going to be like a fucking eclipse.
Why did you take so long to name Bret Hart after Montreal?
I don't really have a good answer for that question other than it was probably just timing. Getting contracts signed and trying to figure out what we were going to do and making sure he was free and clear, but there was no, you know, like, monumental kind of hurdle that we had to overcome that I can remember.
Along that same question, let's go to the flip side. Let's talk about what happened prior to Brett leaving in Montreal. Backstory as far as that's concerned, and then what led to that, and then what was the attitude and the feeling when he did show up on Montreal?
Yeah, you know, the Montreal thing has been just played to death. And, you know, it was simply a bad deal. Brett had come to Vince, and Vince had offered him this really crazy, stupid deal. And Brett was like, well, Gunn, you're offering me $3 million over here to go down to Ted Turner, and I'd make $3 million a year, 4 years. So, and Brett
wasn't
that much. But I'm telling you what, from our side, what we were doing. And it got to the point that every time that Vince would thank Brett, or goddamn pal, you know, and glad you're here, and type thing. Yeah, he'll be making $3 million down, you know, a little bit of inflation, 4 years. And it it became that like Vince was going, this is an expensive proposition that were to guarantee as much money as it did guarantee Brett for 10 years. Then he said, you know what, Brett? I don't want to stand in your way of making the money that you say you're being offered. So I'm going to let you out of your deal, which probably really you couldn't afford at the time anyway, and go down there, man. Go make the money. Go make the money while you can, because they're not going to offer you that kind of money in a year from now or 2 years from now. And if we lock you up and you're going to be here, you're going to be here. And Vince kind of thought he was doing Brett a favor by go take the money. Go do it. And then Brett was like, well, golly, it's breaking my contract. They don't really love me anymore. And, you know, Brett's an emotional guy. He just wore his emotions on his sleeve. And there was just no good to come out of it in any way, shape, or form. And then he was a Canadian hero, couldn't lose in Canada. So we had to do what we had to do to protect our business and protect the company. So.
Do you feel like that's a moment that changed the wrestling business entirely? Or?
I don't know if it did or not. I mean, I guess if you're Canadian, it did.
Yes. No, I think it clearly did. It allowed Vince McMahon to become a character.
That's, well, you know what? Without a doubt, because Vince McMahon became, Vince in his own fucked up head, thought people only saw him as an announcer.
Nobody's coming. He was following my lead. A year later, yeah. He was the announcer.
He was just like, no. Because those that worked with him, by the way, the heel Vince McMahon, they ain't no acting there. That is real life. Those promos was usually shit that I was like, hey, remember the time that I fucked this up? Yeah. I mean, we had a lot of material to work with. But he would sit there and look at us like,
I'm a play-by-play guy. Nobody knows that I own, nobody cares about Vince McMahon.
Dude, you're an asshole. Just go be one on air. And that enabled him he would walk out to go do Raw. And they booed the living shit out of him. And he was like, oh, damn, why do they hate me? Because you own the place. You fuck Brett. And it allowed him to accept that character. But I mean, where he was acting was being played by play guy.
Oh my, and then from there, what a maneuver.
That was acting. I dare the motherfucker to call one hold, one move, anything.
Oh my, what a maneuver.
He's a heartbreaker. I'm sorry, I had to digress. This is during the Monday Night War, so you won't get mad at me. We do a lot of work with the Special Olympics. So Shawn Michaels is wrestling Stone Cold Steve Austin. And Steve was a heel. So Steve takes a bump outside, and this young man who was special hops the railing, man, and goes after Steve. Steve looks up, sees, okay, well, I got something going on here. Steve gets away from him. Shawn rolls out and gets the kid, takes control of the situation. And Vince is on commentary. He says, well, one of our Special Olympians in the crowd has got a little over exuberant.
I don't want to answer that. The fuck makes you think he's a Special Olympian? But that's the way he was, man. He just saw things in his own tweaked way. And it was like, okay.
Oh, my.
Yeah, he thought that people only saw him as that commentary guy.
Speaking of seeing things in his only tweaked way... Vince didn't come out as the heel announcer and the authority figure and the oppressive owner of the company until over a year after I did that. And he followed the model so closely that he actually wore a black jean jacket on camera for the first time he actually put his padded suit coat up and quit dressing like an old mafia guy and started showing up with a t-shirt and a black jean jacket and becoming kind of hip and cool.
It's true. Yeah.
It is true.
It's true. Yeah.
Go back and look at the tapes. I ain't lying. It took him a year to figure out that the authority figure and the oppressive bully owner, you know, George Steinbrenner type of character actually worked. But it took me 12 or 13 months to convince him of that.
So now, back to that first Monday Night Nitro, and then that catapulted you into where you were with arm's reach, WBF. Where was the turning point? Where was that next moment that you finally won one? You finally won one Monday Night. You finally beat WWF in the ratings.
Honestly, I don't remember. It was 18 years ago or so. Do you?
Bash, after Bash. With Hogan. When Hogan turned,
96.
'96. When Hogan turned, that next Monday was the first one you guys won. Just didn't look back.
And what was the reaction? What was the attitude on the other side to the fact that they had actually beaten?
Well, first it was an aberration. Well, they won one. Goddamn, get one every fucking blind squirrel find another every once in a while.
How's it have to do that?
It was an aberration first. You know, those goddamn black limousines started showing up. Who's gonna come out next? Who's it gonna be next? And that was enough for everybody to tune in, see who's next. It was enough for us, we take a roll call, on Mondays. Who's here? Who's in here? Is that some bitch jumping? What the hell's going on? So that was pretty much it. Bash and Hogan turning.
Do you think, I mean, obviously Hogan turning is monumental, no denying it. But do you think it was so much who's going to jump as it was a change in the presentation of the product? Because we changed it.
I don't think so.
No?
No.
I think it was who's going over next.
The thing with WWF was at the time, it was the same core guys that were on the top. And they did. They just stayed. Am I not correct?
Kind of true
just
today.
Just stayed like this. It's true today. That's why the business is faltering. And then everybody stayed in the middle. Middle guys lost to the top guys. Top guys only lost to the top guys. And everybody beat bottom guys. But you could almost correct me if I'm wrong.
I would.
Thank you. Could almost even, as just a fan, with no inner knowledge of the business, you could predict or have an idea of what the outcome was going to be. There was no surprise, which is part of the fun, the magic of wrestling, is that you can't predict, you can't expect. And with WCW at the time, always another talent showing up allowed you to be able to spring yet another surprise every week. Oh, who's going to show up next week? And that really began, I think, the drive of books.
And that's a really good point, and it takes me back to something that I should have touched on earlier. When Ted said, "Eric, don't do Monday nights," along on my list of things, okay, how can we do differently? We did some research. I'm in the television business. I have a television production company that has since 2003. We do a lot of TV realities, a couple sitcoms. I'm in the business. Research is a really important part of the process. And early on, and this is really where I give credit to the success of Nitro, if I'm going to be really honest with myself and with you guys, is there was a research company, and we did three focus groups. We got just people like you guys that watched WWE, WWF at the time, they watched WCW at the time. There were different groups. There was people that considered themselves hardcore fans, regular fans. There were peripheral fans that watched once or twice a month. There were people that watched occasionally. There were people that used to watch but didn't watch anymore. So we, the research company, it was an independent company, broke them down into separate groups. And then we presented WWF product to them, presented the WCW product to them. And we were sitting behind a one-way mirror, so they couldn't see us, but we could see them. We gave them little dials that were all integrated into a computer. So we would show them stuff on the screen, and we would say, okay, if you like what you see, turn it to the right. If you don't like what you see, turn it to the left. And it was all kind of like wired into one big graph. So we could literally put stuff up on the screen and watch how people reacted in real time to what they were seeing. And one of the things I learned out of that, there was a couple things, actually. They were pretty substantial. But one of the things that I learned is that surprises. People love to be surprised and shocked and presented with something that they didn't expect to happen. That was like one of the key elements that I took away from that research. And I went, okay, so along like on my yellow tablet, I have to put surprise. And by the way, I'm going to bring this up. I haven't brought it up before. SARSA. Surprise, action, reality, S-A-R.
It's your yellow pad.
Jesus Christ. Can't remember. But there was like five elements where if you could check the boxes on those five, if you could create a show that had surprise, anticipation, reality, suspense, action. If you could do all of those things and check all of those boxes, you win. Three out of five, decent show. Two out of five, boom, you get the dirt. And that was one of the things that research taught us is surprise. It was one of the things that wrestling fans want more than anything. If you can sit back and go, okay, here's what I'm going to see on Monday Night Raw tonight, and you're going to be 80% right, you probably aren't going to be excited about coming back next week. But if you can give them something they didn't see coming,
you're going to be. Into a lot of that point, you're dealing with, on our side, dealing with an eccentric owner who would probably take the same data.
What they're really trying to tell you here, pal, is they don't like surprises. They just were shocked at that. So, well, we'll shock
him. And he would twist things that, and so they go, nah, I think they want to be fucking surprised. I mean, it's made it do. And when you get to reality, trying to explain sometimes to Vince, well, I watch a lot of reality. I like Survivor. I like Amazing Race. I like, you know, elimination type reality. And when we would do the, oh God, I hate to even say this out, the Diva Search stuff, you know, he would look at it as what people are interested in. They want to know about the winners.
Nobody wants to know about the losers who's eliminated. Forget about them.
I said, no, I said, you really need to build the show around who's going to be eliminated.
Nobody cares who's eliminated. They care who survives.
Not what reality elimination shows are about until you get to the end. Who wins? But in between, lead up, it's who's getting eliminated? Who's getting kicked off? And in his mind, people didn't care, but people didn't want to dwell in the negative.
God, give him positive. Is that God damn Hulk Hogan? He's got to drop the leg and he's got to pose.
But that's the animated cartoonish right. Tendency in him. And by the way, it's story, anticipation, reality, surprise, and action. That's SARSA. Okay? And if you hit all five, and I believe it to this day, if you hit all five of those, you're great. But if you underestimate surprise, or if you think, story doesn't matter, that's TNA. Story doesn't matter. You just need to go out and do this. Just do it. Well, fuck. Have you ever read a book that didn't have a beginning and a middle and an end?
Why?
Have you ever watched a television commercial for 30 freaking seconds that didn't have a beginning and a middle and an end? Why in the hell would you watch a wrestling show or a storyline that doesn't have a beginning and a middle and an end?
Isn't
sorry, I went off on a tangent on that one. I believe it's story.
But you know, you brought up the reality thing. What did that have to do with why Vince continued to stay stagnant
in spite
of them starting to gain ground?
It was a formula that worked, guys. It was Hulk loses, but by God, he's got to come back afterwards. He's got to hit Andre in the head with the belt and pose. Hogan has to pose. That was a flop. And this microphone sucks. But it was something that worked. So you make people happy. You leave them on an up. You leave them happy. And until something else, an alternative came along, wasn't making people happy. It was going the traditional get heat. So God, you're begging for a hero to come along. Then you make a hero.
But that works. It's two different things though.
I'm sorry, but that was prior. The heat was you were bringing out new talent every week. Am I correct? Prior to before you really turned the corner and got
heat, but heat worked.
It did. And it always does. But prior to ever getting to that point, they were winning based off the one precept of surprise.
And we're getting a little granular here, I think. But going back to reality versus not, it really comes down to like a really high altitude kind of view of things. If you want really animated kind of, I hate to say cartoonish because it sounds negative, but a garbage man, a butcher, whatever,
and a plumber.
You know, WCW's approach, Nitro's approach, was this is real shit. We're going to let you backstage. We're going to show you things you've never seen before. And oh, by the way, Kevin Nash is going to become some goofy ass character name.
Like Glacier.
Yeah, I mean, Glacier. Shit the bed of Glacier.
I stole that from the last
couldn't,
one. Sorry.
I couldn't be everything to everybody all at the same time. I'll take that one. But the majority of the transition between what made WCW work against WWF at the time was that we had reality-based storylines. People use the word reality very effectively in many situations. But if you look, go back and look at 1996. Go back and look at the way we presented that product. What was reality then versus what was reality for WWF at that time? We used our own, Scott Hall was Scott Hall. Kevin Nash was Kevin Nash.
True. Scott Hall did not speak with a Spanish accent.
He still does to this day. Come on, man.
You got a question.
You're wrong.
You have a question? Come on.
I've got another one.
My Spanish accent may stop me from being understood.
Me want to drink beer, but go ahead.
It's kind of going off what you were talking about with reality. This was just something that I always was interested in when it happened. And it's everyone talks about the DX invasion and being off the scope. But around the same time, you on the TV and Nitro and you challenged Vince McMahon to a match at Slamboree. And I remember as a kid watching that going, what's going to happen? Like, in my head, I know Vince isn't going to show up, but what's going to happen? So, from your perspective, what made you decide to do that, and did you have any plans in place in case somehow did show up? And then from your side, what was the reaction when that event went on TV? Did Vince have any sort of part of I'm going to go, fuck it.
That's a really good question. That's
a great question.
Go ahead. I'll take it first, I'll hand it off to you.
What made me do it was the fact that Bruce, the dick that he was, he still is. He cowered. He came up with the idea of DX invading, the scope, and they took a page out of our book. They went, okay, well, this is, we're going to do shit that's off the charts and things that have never been done before. And
what was going on inside the building when those guys were outside doing all that?
Well, from my perspective, I'll just speak for myself. And I could be wrong about this. This is like 18 years ago or whatever it was, 16 years ago. But if I remember correctly, I was in the ring. I had an IFB in my ear because the person at ringside kind of kept the flow going. And I heard, people from, WWE are here and they're breaking down doors. They're trying to get in the building. And I was so confused. I just didn't know what to do. I was on live TV, for fuck's sake. So, I could go, let's just stop down and figure it out. So I had to ad lib and improvise it. And at the, while I was trying to process all that, security, who, you know, they had a job to do. They were shutting stuff down. They were doing what they think they should have done and shutting it down. I was kind of like, I was caught flat-footed, to be really honest. I mean, he got me. I didn't know what to do. I was confused.
Where did the idea spring from? Where did the concept come out?
We had an agents meeting. It was like either 2 weeks before or a week before. And the question was raised. All the agents are there. It's like, you know, goddamn, you know, these guys are kicking. They're kicking our ass. Television wise. And
could you, real quick, and I don't mean to talk, could you explain what an agent is?
An agent is usually a former wrestler that helps put matches together and work with the talent, so on and so forth. He already does his part, he's going to cringe anyway, so.
I'm going to try to kill this mic, is what I'm going to try to
hang. So, it was thrown out to the agents. Well, you know, in the old days, man, you know, what would you do? I mean, what these guys basically are coming into our territory, they're coming in and beating us at the game that we owned in our mind. And I just raised my hand and said, shit, the old days, territory days, back in old days, if opposition ever came in, you took your toughest guys and you went and challenged them. You went and knocked on their door. They'll be opposition. So if you've got a promotion that's running San Jose, they're there every week, and you want to come in and you want to run San Jose, and you bring your biggest, baddest son bitches you've got, and you walk right in the front door, you say, I want you, their biggest, baddest they got. Knock on their door. So we kind of mulled it around and thought, you know, it was actually very coincidental that the Norfolk thing came up, because we were only 40 miles away in between where we were running. Perfect time. Let's go say hello. And that's what we did. it was great. We had the cops there from Norfolk. I had the head of the police station who was on my side. They had Doug Dillinger who was calling the cops, and they all come up, and my cop is yelling at them. So it was great. I said, what can I do? You can't think you want to. It's my town. I was like, okay, cool. So I mean, we went right to the door. I had orders from my attorneys that told me I couldn't go in.
Can I ask another question?
Yeah.
How did you get this cop to be so willing to allow you to, goddamn, it's my town. You can do whatever heck you want.
They're in Norfolk, Virginia. Headless, no. but yeah, I mean, this guy was great. He took us around, and we had great security. But that was the whole idea, was that they were there, so let's just go say hello to them and
bullshit.
And then knock on their door.
Bullshit, go say hello to them.
Well, that's what we did.
What was the reaction from that?
From who?
From both sides.
Oh, well, shit, we had their people chanting, you know, DX, 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 and everyone we interviewed had gotten free tickets. And the beauty of it all is... The beauty of it all, okay? Huge billboard, all right?
Oh, God.
Up there. And it says, WCW Nitro. Flip the screen. Free tickets. And we're shooting this thing, and a cameraman, who was also a director for us at the time, Timmy Walden, nobody notices this. Timmy sees it and goes, Bruce, look at the billboard, look at it. And we shoot it. So the first thing you see is WCW Nitro free tickets, and then the DX invasion and what have you. So it was a perfect storm. All things came together. It was pretty cool. All right.
It was a perfect storm.
So besides offering surprises, I think another instrumental part of it. Hold on a second. I'll get to you just a second. Myself, I have a question. I think another instrumental part of it was that you were offering something different, being that I think you were the first United States to really introduce the general public into Japanese talent and lucha talent. Do you think that, what did that do and what was the reaction from WWF, even though I know the reaction because I was asked to be a Mexican at one point.
With who the fuck would ask you something like that?
A bilingual Puerto Rican midget. That's my manager. Which I love midgets.
I'm going to stand up for this one because it's an important one. When you look back at Nitro and you look back at the history of this business, people ask me all the time, what are you most proud of? Honestly, I was fortunate and grateful to have been in the right place at the right time, right situation at the right moment. Things just worked out. And it paid off really well for my family and for me personally, and I'm grateful for that. But if I'm really honest about the one thing that made Nitro different, more different than, you know, I talk about reality and I talk about Sarsa and I talk about all the things that we did, but the one thing that made us so much better than the competition was that we embraced diversity. We brought in Lucha and put it on a big platform. And nothing, it had been done before. Paul Heyman did it. He had Lucha guys working for him in ECW. Nobody watched it. There were like 12 people sitting around, you know, television set watching it somewhere.
That's not true.
And 32!
Oh, I'm sorry. It's not true.
Bingo.
Mostly true.
That was not true.
But, it, you know, we brought Lucha, we brought the Japanese style of wrestling and a lot of Japanese into it. And we not only brought them in, we put them on a pedestal. We made it kind of a centerpiece of our show. It made our show different than the competition. Go back to what I said earlier. Be better than or be different than. We couldn't be better than what WWF did at the time. But we became different by introducing, at a very high level, Lucha, Japanese style of wrestling, and a lot of Japanese that came over. And that gave us just such a diverse and action-packed show that it was one of the things that really made us better than. Because you're either going to be different than, worse than, or better than. And we became better than them because we introduced that style of wrestling.
What was the reaction with WWF?
Well, I'll disagree with putting them on a pedestal. I think that it was great train wreck television. That's actually using your term. It allowed the audience to see a completely different style of wrestling, a different style of wrestler. Our battle then with using international talent was, okay, can they speak English? Can they communicate with the audience? And in order for them to be a character, we wanted everybody to be able to communicate with the audience. Which, you know, hindsight being 2020 and reality staring you in the face, I mean, what, 80% of the United States speaks Spanish? So, come on, you know, it's, you can be bilingual. And I think you guys did a great job. I think they did a great job of that. And but that was our roadblock. Our roadblock was that we wanted everybody to be able to communicate with the audience, make them a character that was relatable, that everybody could understand. And
but what changed? Because then you started bringing your own.
Which we did, but they spoke English. They were able, a lot of them did, yeah.
See, that,
but I mean, that was a criteria. That was a huge criteria. Remember at the time, though, you had Vince Russo, who didn't understand anybody.
Who didn't understand anybody
coming to New York. Okay?
Hold on. We'll get to him.
No, we won't.
Shouldn't we?
Yeah.
But here's the difference, though. Yes, I did refer to it as Crash TV or Car Wreck TV. But if you could trade Wreck TV, but if you remember, if you go back and watch Nitros, and I encourage you to do this because the WWE Network has lots of Nitros that you can all watch now. And some of you may be watching something you weren't aware of or even had the opportunity to see before. But if you go back and look, here's the way I formatted the show. And it wasn't by freaking accident. My philosophy was, with the Japanese and the Mexican wrestlers that we brought in, was to put them at the 9 o'clock hour to put them in the transition, which, by the way, if you're producing a television show, you put your best stuff at the beginning, at the middle, and at the end. That's how you format a show. I don't care if it's frickin' Survivor, if it's a sitcom, or if it's the nightly news. You put your best stuff at the beginning, in the middle, during the transition hour, and at the end. And I definitively put our international wrestling at that 9 o'clock hour because I didn't want to lose an audience to the WWE. Wrestlers in the industry, it's like, oh, I'm not on the main event. I'm not that important. Bullshit. If you're at that transition hour, you are just as important as the guy that's in the main event.
If not more.
If not more. Because that's where you have a chance to lose a massive amount of audience. So I positioned our Trainwreck TV, if you will, the Japanese, the Mexicans, the losers that we brought in, at that 9 o'clock hour, because that's how important I thought it was.
Did that shift attitude or perception within WWF as far as smaller wrestlers, because most of the international talent was smaller, and WWF is historically a big man territory?
Yes and no, but by definition, unfortunately, a lot of times the smaller talent became lesser than talent. They were either middle of the road or lower card until you got to guys. I mean, Eddie Guerrero, you know, broke that mold. And then you got Rey Mysterio, who those smaller guys made. But no, unfortunately, a lot of them couldn't break that size barrier.
Who's going to believe a little midget like that's going to beat a big guy like that?
And I always used to use, because it was a conversation, Randy Savage and Curtis Hughes were working with each other. Curtis Hughes comes to Vince and says, you mean to tell me that people are going to believe that that little guy is going to be able to beat me?
He didn't kill me.
And this is Curtis talking about Randy Savage. And Vince looks at him and says,
they will when they see it, pal.
I like it.
And that's the truth. Yeah, that's the truth.
Come on up. We're in Hollywood.
And then in terms of the award, a few years ago I got really excited because, you know, the whole TNA Hogan's jumps, you know, Flair's doing it all of a sudden. So that Nitro roster was starting to build up with some really cool new guys as well. What, and I don't mean any disrespect, but we're talking about war here right now. What is keeping TNA afloat right now that WCW went down the tubes? Because WCW had better ratings than TNA right now. What is, you know, I don't know if that's too long of a question.
Who's that question?
It just really kind of veered like off in another direction, but
everybody.
I've been keeping this going in a certain pace and a certain direction, but you just took it.
I'll just take it off in the fucking woods. we were nowhere near being angry. We were going to get there, but fuck it. Let's go.
Go ahead. Take over.
But no, because everybody here involved in this, you know, in the past few years, involved in this situation, it's a battle is still coming.
Yeah. Well, back to your question of how does TNA survive, despite the fact
that WCW, yeah.
Which we were going to do.
Oh, sorry.
Just it's okay. You're young. You're premature.
So, you're just hot that he asked a great question.
I'm not hot that he asked a great question. That was a question we were going to get to.
How's hot?
It just, chronologically, we're now out of place. So, we might as well go ahead and deal with it. Thank you. Why? I don't even know if that's a reasonable question.
I got it.
What would lead to the failure? Led to the failure of WCW? What led to the demise, ultimately, and therefore then that same thing would not apply to TNA because they don't have the same circumstances.
Hollywood. Circumstances.
But the environment is...
It is.
A different situation that you had.
It's like comparing apples to bricks. WCW was a part of a major network in a major publicly held corporation
in a conglomerate that was controlled ultimately by AOL, Time Warner. By the way, you can't even find AOL on anybody's doors anymore. They don't even exist. But AOL,
Time Warner.
WCW was trying to survive in a corporate environment that was entirely different than the environment or the circumstances, as I'm pointing out, that TNA is trying to survive. So it's not really comparable. It's like saying, you know, how do I become a standout running back on my high school football team versus how do I become an outstanding running back for the Dallas Cowboys or the New England Patriots? It's two different standards. TNA is doing the best they can with the tools that they have and the opportunities that exist for them. WCW couldn't survive with the tools that they had and the environment that they existed in when the AOL Time Warner merger occurred. So you can't really compare the two, to be honest. It's just not fair. But it's a great question. Thank you for asking.
Try to get us on track.
Well, it was a fucking amazing question and a great answer.
I'm going to have to err on the other side, but go ahead.
Well, we've always heard the story that you, Eric, had plans towards the end of WCW that you had a company, a group that you wanted to try to buy. If you can kind of speak on what your plans would have been if that had happened, if the company had folded. And then I'm also kind of curious, what was going on behind the scenes of WWE during that time, that 6 months prior to WCW going under? Were you guys preparing for the victory? And then were there any conversations going on regarding their potential purchase?
I'll take the first part, and I'll keep it short. I had a group of investors by the name of Fusion Media, which, by the way, started CBS College Sports and a lot of other really hugely successful endeavors in media that would basically raise $67 million to buy WCW from Time Warner. Part of that deal was that we would get television distribution on TNT and TBS. At the very last minute, that deal fell apart, and Jamie Kellner, who was with Time Warner, I believe, at the time, came in and said, we're going to blow up every deal that's on the table. We're starting from scratch, including our deal. So after a year or more of raising money, and you put, you know, a deal together, basically a proposal together, we did all of our due diligence, we did everything we needed to do. We thought the deal was done. And at the last minute, the deal turned. My reaction was, that was the point where I talked about earlier where I swung away from the wrestling business. But up to that point, we were going to relaunch it, and the strategy, to answer your question, was to essentially make it go away. Meaning, you know, there's a part of psychology and human nature that absence makes the heart grow fonder. You know, you two may be really close friends, and then you start getting on each other's nerves, but if you don't see each other for 6 months, you kind of forget that you got on each other's nerves. And that's what we were with WCW. We knew that if we were going to buy that company and relaunch it, that we had to really relaunch it, which means it had to go away. And we had to bring in fresh talent. We had to rebrand it. That was the only real strategy we had at that point.
To answer part two of your question, as far as like 6 months before, there was no interest, there was no desire. You were acquiring, in a lot of respects, a dead brand. When, was it Jamie Kellner?
Jamie Kellner.
Okay. Well, when he came in and basically said all deals are off the table and everything's dead, that opened up another door. Because then the gentleman that was our CEO, Stu, God, I can't remember, Schwartz, thank you. Stu then went in and said, hey, what do you guys have? We were interested in the TNT time slot.
Stu Schwartz, by the way, used to work for Churn,
right,
while I did. So he had an inside view of the asset value of that company.
Which is why we had no interest in buying it before then. So then Stu went in and says, well,
what could we do? We were more interested in, I believe, the Thursday night, the Thunder Times line. Okay? And we were like, hey, let's go ahead and buy this as long as we can have that Thursday night time slot. Like, no.
I didn't know that.
Yeah. That was the whole reason. That was the whole reason we even entered into it, was to create competition for ourselves. Sorry. And when they were like, we're out of the wrestling business, we don't want to do that. And he says, well, what do you have? I mean, what do you sell? And that's when they acquired the video rights, all the television. I think we took a bunch of their rings.
Tourists only two, brother.
No, we got a bunch from the power plant. You guys have. I think we got like about 24 rings.
Not much, yeah. What did you pay for all that?
Well, not a lot.
It's a couple million. I think it was about 2 or 3 million. A
couple million.
We had offered $67 million. And by the way, I did a whole dog and pony show on Wall Street with the company was then called Pincus Warburg. Warburg Investments is one of the biggest investment companies in the world right now. We raised $67 million from blue chip investors, and they turned, or AOL Time Warner turned it down for $2
million. We paid a couple. Yeah. The deal was literally done in about 2 weeks. And it was strictly from the standpoint of Jamie Kellner come in and said, yeah, man, we're looking at this completely all over. And we went in going, oh, shit, let's get that Thursday night time slot.
By the way, Jamie Kellner is selling used cars and somewhere down in San Mateo. I don't think he even has his real job.
So tell us what happened the night that you came in and took over the engine.
That was a cool night. We drank a lot. No, Shane McMahon, Jerry Briscoe, and I flew down to Panama City. Nitro set up, and we met with everyone. And everybody was kind of on pins and needles because they didn't know what was happening. I mean, it was announced either that day or something. And we came in and met with everybody, and we didn't know what was going to happen. All we knew is that they had a live show. We had to produce that. We were going to simulcast with USA, which I know TNT was not really happy about, but we did it anyway. And please silence your cell phone. And it was just a really bizarre atmosphere, but it was also a very cool atmosphere because you were witnessing history and we all had fun with it. But the guys were a little bit on edge.
What was your reaction, Eric? You were obviously removed from it, but you were still, I'm sure, somewhat emotionally invested. What was your reaction?
Yeah, I was in a funk at that time. It was, you know, shortly after, you know, I was sent home on September 10th, 1999, and this happened shortly thereafter. Not too far after. And I didn't watch it. I couldn't get myself to watch it because it was like, you know, watching your child get beat up at school. Just like, you know what happens, but you don't want to watch it. It was an odd feeling. You know, there's still, you know, there was scar tissue still, and I think that night kind of picked up the scab a little bit. What are you laughing at, Wolfer? There's some shit I see that's funny, but that's not funny.
That's funny. You talk about what you remember about that night. I remember the three of us got on the plane. We had the corporate jet with us. So we were going to go to Cleveland, pick them up, and then fly to Detroit. And Cleveland and Detroit, there's a blizzard moving in, man. And snow's coming out sideways. And the corporate jet is usually stocked heavily with some pretty good fucking Merlot. And a lot of it. We drank every bottle of wine, half a bottle of Jack, and half the beer on the flight from Panama City to Cleveland. So much so that they had to call Cleveland to get more wine so that when Vince got on the plane, he had wine. That's what I remember about it. It was a good time. And then, yeah.
I'm shocked you remember anything.
I know. Yeah, then Jerry Briscoe started taking everything down.
Well, this is a question actually for all three of you. If you guys could talk about your experience and opinions about the possibility of a wrestler's union, either in the past or the present or the future, because you guys have been in so many different companies, I feel like that's something that's never really been talked about.
Mm-hmm. You're the wrestler.
From a wrestler standpoint, torn. You want the security and the idea of having, you know, a union behind you and fight for injustice. All it ends up doing is giving you ultimately end up giving your own responsibility to take care of your own business away to somebody else, is that you get all your rights to take care of that business, which now gives them a watch to take care of your business for you. Sometimes that's not always in your best interest. They say it is, or they say it's in the group's best interest. They don't need yours. I can make my own fate. Granted, I haven't done a great job, I think sometimes, but at least I can still make my own fate the way things stand now. It's not perfect by any stretch of the imagination, but I don't think that a union, per se, necessarily might benefit the wrestling business. I think it would further change it to a point that would disenfranchise the very intrinsic things that keep it alive, so much so that it becomes something different and then ceases to exist.
And I think that, I'm sorry, from the other side, I don't know that you would ever be able to form one union that could govern. I mean, you've got all your independents, you've got everybody under the sun running. To be a part of a union, but everybody's got to be a part of it. Realistically, I don't see it ever being able to come to fruition for everybody to work together. It's never been something that's been able to be done in this business.
And if you're on top, when you're making money, why do you care if nobody else is? So you're the person that has the most. The person who, there are two things in this business you want. You're either the thing that sells tickets or the other thing that helps sell tickets. There is no third option. Am I correct?
Mm-hmm.
So, if you're the thing that's selling tickets, you have the most stroke. You have the most power. You can call your shots. You kind of do what you want. What's going to benefit you? Now, get everybody else on board. Create you.
I'll take it from a business perspective. Al said it best at the very end. His position, but if wrestling was unionized right now, we wouldn't be here. We couldn't A, afford to be here. That's it. We couldn't afford to be here because that cameraman or that cameraman or Rob in the back, we would all have to be part of a union that would make your tickets cost about $85 or $100 a piece, and you couldn't do it. Unions had a point in time when they were really important. Not anymore. Now unions are about raising money to give to the party that supports them the most. And they suck the lifeblood, they suck the financial ability out of people that are independent promoters or independent business people. It's not even a restaurant. If you want to open up a store in Santa Monica, or, you know, California is like the best example of the worst situation for unions. You're taxed, you're controlled, you're manipulated, you have to go through bureaucratic bullshit to the point where you can't do things like we're doing right now. If there was a wrestling union, we wouldn't be sitting here right now having this conversation. I'm 100% sure of that.
And you wouldn't want to watch it. Because it would kill the very thing that breeds magic and moments that create talent to allow them to stand out from the crowd. You wouldn't have Steve Austin. You wouldn't have Hulk Hogan. You wouldn't have go down the list.
And honestly, Al, if I may, I don't mean to interrupt you. Respect you. My son broke into this business now, but 6 or 7 years ago, or 4 or 5 years ago, I wasn't a big fan of it. I didn't want him to do it because I know how tough this business is. And I also see the trajectory of it, and I see where it's going, and you're either with one company or you're not. And it's very hard to make a good living doing it. But if this business were unionized, WWE would probably cease to exist. If WWE would have to conform, if WWE didn't have the ability to be an independent contractor kind of base company, they would not exist. An entire industry would evaporate overnight.
I actually had a couple of questions. One was a follow-up to one that was asked earlier. What would you have done if Vince actually did show up? And the second question is, you had a big build-up for Star King for a whole year where Sting said nothing and then eventually wrestled Hogan, and I think it was one of Bret Hart's first appearances, and the whole idea was supposed to be that Nick Patrick was going to give a fast count and Bret Hart was going to say no one's going to screw anybody again. And it turned out to be a slower count than normal. And was that, I guess, a botched count, or was that planned that way, or was there some issue going on with that? Because I've always wanted to ask you that. I know it's a specific question. It is pretty specific. And we're also prepared for this last part of it, which was, since you talked so much about, I guess it's three questions.
That's true.
Since you talked so much about surprises, and I asked you this earlier, but I told you I'd ask you again. Since you talked so much about surprises, in today's world of the internet, where everybody knows everything that's going on, you were still closely held secret that you were going to be the GM until you walked backstage and said hello to Booker T, and it just completely crapped on the surprise. Why?
Okay.
So, if Vince McMahon showed up, let's take him in sequential order. Vince McMahon showed up, what would you have done? I mean, you're black belt karate and you're capable of handling it. This big son of a bitch. I mean, and he's, you know, works out
a lot. When was that? 16, 18 years ago?
Yeah.
16 or 18 years ago. Like, today, I would have shit my pants. 16 or 18 years ago, I'd have fought him, and I probably would have beat him, in my mind. I wrestled from grade school, junior high, all the way through high school. I got a scholarship to college. So amateur wrestling is not something that's unfamiliar to me. Greco and freestyle. I was a kickboxer, Sonny Ono back there, who I competed with around the country as a amateur karate guy. And I stepped into kickboxing towards the end of my career. And I actually trained as a golden belt boxer after that. So I grew up in Detroit for fuck's sake. So it's something that comes fairly natural to me. And my wife, you know, if she hears any of this, which by the way, I'm going to hold all of you accountable. I used to say this all the time, that in most cases, I'd rather fight than have sex. Not anymore. Sonny will tell you that.
Hey, I being a third party, you know, not Eric talking, but I will tell you that, knowing Eric for most of my life, you know, I watched Eric bop from many, many places, in the ring and outside the ring, and you know, in places where you're not supposed to be fighting without getting arrested. And I know Eric getting beat up by Chicago cops. A lot of it. He's a tough guy. And I will honestly say, not knowing Vince McMahon, and I know Vince is a big guy, and I don't know how much fighting he has. I mean, actual fighting. I know
Eric.
How
much does he have, Bruce? How much fighting does he have?
Yeah, yeah. But
do you guys ever tussle in the house there or anything?
I'll put my money on there.
Strip yourselves naked? Butt up the wall? Or go down in the living room? Under the big,
I don't want to go over
here. Right, bear skin rug.
Picture of Vince over the fireplace. That is happy, guys.
My point.
That's it.
My point was going to be to answer your question. I assumed he was going to show up. Hulk Hogan, yeah, no, I did. And we actually told everybody, we had security, Doug Dillinger, and all the security people say, look, I mean, we made the, I challenged him, I did the shit I did. I wasn't sure if he was going to show up, but here's the funniest part of this whole thing. As I did that, it was kind of a spontaneous reaction to the whole DX thing. I thought, okay, I'm going to go one up him. I'm just going to call him out. And then, right after I did it, Hulk Hogan came up. We were in somewhere, I think we were in New York or somewhere at a hotel. He was, you have no idea what he just did. Because he'll show up. He'll fight you. I'm like, cool. Because to Sonny's point, I've had my ass kicked so many times by so many people for no money. I thought, well, here's how it's going to go. He's either going to show up and I'm going to beat his ass, or he's going to not show up and he's going to be a pussy. Or he's going to show up and I'm going to kick his ass. I win, I win, I win. I'm in!
What was Vince's reaction to this?
Oh, he laughed at it. He thought it was clever that they were going to try and draw a house on him showing up kicking his ass.
He never entertained the idea of taking Eric Blunder's challenge.
What? He shows up, kicks his ass, he loses. He shows up, kicks his ass, he loses. He had a job, he loses. I mean, it was why?
What was your second question?
The second question was about the slow fast count.
The slow fast count, which was very
slow. Oh, God, I'm like,
I'm just going to be really honest with you. It was a funky situation. It didn't go the way it was supposed to go. I'm not sure if there wasn't a little bit of coercion and manipulation going on with some principles involved. It did not go the way it was supposed to go.
Okay. Last question.
And the third part was about the surprise as you as the GM being backstage and skid.
Yeah, why'd you blow me?
I didn't blow it. Bruce did. Here's what you learn in the rest of the business. Put the heat on the guy that's not in the room. That way you always look good. But if you asked the question earlier, and Bruce and I both talked about it. Here's the conundrum that you're faced with as being a television producer, as opposed to just being a live event producer. As a television producer, if you watch what audiences do on a minute by minute, almost second by second basis, they just go back and forth and back and forth. And your goal as a producer is to hold that audience as much as you can, not lose them. So you format your whole show in a way that's going to grab, maintain, and build an audience. And sometimes you make decisions that are right. Sometimes you make decisions that are wrong, that are designed to hook that audience. And not speaking for Bruce or anybody that was on the creative side, because I wasn't a part of that conversation. I didn't get a vote. But the idea, I think, and I'll let Bruce correct me when I'm wrong, was that, look, we're going to do this big thing. It is kind of a big deal. At that time it was. Let's hook the audience through a commercial break so they don't leave us and go check out whatever the fuck they checked out. You can go back and you can look at it in retrospect and say, was it the right idea? Was it the wrong idea? Hindsight's always 20/20. I think it was probably the right idea, because you needed to stimulate conversation at that time. And it did.
And wouldn't that be you really not directing the product to your point, to just the internet fans, but to the general audience that, to be quite frank, I have the best of interest in wrestling, and I go on the internet, the only thing I do is check my email, go on Facebook, and occasional porn site. That's about it. So, I don't go on any wrestling websites, and I've been doing this for 33 years. I give a shit less. So I can't imagine Mr. and Mrs. Walmart running and get on the computer and are now realizing that, oh, shit, Eric's going to be the GM. Well, I don't need to watch that show.
But the reason behind it is, as you said, it was to hook the audience. Simply to hook the audience and let everybody else at home have the same reaction, hopefully, the booker was having. Did I just see who I thought I just saw? And now I can't leave because, oh, my God, that was Eric Bischoff. What the hell are they going to do with him? He's not going to be the new GM. Never in a million years. And you second guess yourself, but it was like a hook on the ends.
Just, did it work?
Yeah, it worked. Yeah.
Okay, so we've only got about 10 minutes left. And both of you have been very instrumental for a very long time in wrestling. Tell me, or tell us, what do you think's your legacy? What do you think were some of your defining moments? How did you change or alter the business And in what direction did you?
Well, I don't know what the hell my legacy is. I've had the, to me, it's a privilege to be a part of the business. And I've been doing this since I was 10 years old. So I just have always loved the business and just happy that I could be a part of it. So,
there's not a particular talent, there's not a particular angle, there's not a particular storyline, there's not a particular moment that you...
Hey, you're talking about to the guy that produced Kate Dick. Okay? Hey, come on. You know, it's not like, you have your ups, you have your downs. I feel very privileged to have been in it as long as I have and contribute as much as I have. It's you have your highs, you have your lows.
How did you contribute? What was your role?
Brother Love.
Well, Brother Love was great. I mean, Brother Love was a blast. I think I contributed a lot more backstage and a lot more behind the scenes. It's great to portray a character. It's great to go out in front of an audience and be a character, be somebody else, and entertain for a while, and just have fun. To me, it's more fun to create a bunch of characters and sit back and watch them all come to life. So if anything, that was my joy. That was my passion. I love to be able to sit there and come up with an idea, look at a guy, you know, this was said to me at the time, man, he's a fucking tall, red-headed basketball player. And then to have the Undertaker come alive. That's the kind of shit that you sit there and go, cool. To have a guy like...
Did you play a part in that creation?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was.
But I was the heart of the shrubbery.
But I mean, there's so many. You know, the guy that made that is Mark Calloway. I mean, you couldn't have done it without him. A million guys you could put in a black outfit and a hat and then call the Undertaker and go out and do it. He did it. He lived it. He became it. To be able to take guys that come in and have... You know, the company look at you and go, they'll never get over it, not with that accent. You go, fuck, I can't let them talk. But, and Eric gets blamed for this quote a lot. How the hell is a guy in black boots and black trunks ever going to get over just wrestling? Stone Cold Steve Austin. All that shit was said about him, but yet it was to sit back and go, goddamn, man, just give him a fucking chance. Giving him a live mic when I was told not to. It let him go. To have The Rock, okay, go out on live TV. What?
There was another moment.
Okay, yeah, but to have The Rock go out on live TV and get eaten alive by DX, because Hunter didn't give a shit. Hunter went out, and Hunter says, "I'm live. I'm gonna take advantage of it." And they had their little script, you know, back in my day, somebody asked you if you had a script and if you had any pills or not. You know, nowadays they got fucking paper words written on it. But they had a script. Well, Rock, man, he was a company man. He could stick to that script. Hunter, DX, they ate him alive. Live. Rock would come back pissed off with, "Why are you guys going off script? I'm fucking doing my job." 2 weeks later, come back and say, "You're live." Yeah. If you take the ass, chew and go for it. And he took that opportunity to go live, and that's how The Rock was born. He and Hunter didn't like each other. I mean, they did not like each other. Made magic together, but that's why they made magic together. Because they truly did not like each other at the time. And Rock went out, man, and he went off script. All of a sudden, Hunter was like, "Ruh-roh." So it was just good shit like that. So I enjoyed being behind the scenes.
What about you, Eric? What you guys just heard for the last minute, 2 minutes, was the passion, the knowledge, and the experience of 40 or 50 years in the business and a fucking phenomenal producer. Phenomenal. Doesn't matter what your title is. Doesn't matter what the internet says or anybody else says. But when you can take that feeling and that knowledge and that experience, and you can transfer it to talent, and you can create emotion. That's what makes a great producer versus a great producer. When I came to WWE, Bruce got saddled with my fat ass. Nobody really wanted to do business with me. Everybody was a little, what is he? Who is he? How is he going to be to work with?
They all knew you. I didn't know.
And Bruce and I first started working right off the bat. He was my producer. And which means, by the way, I worked for him. When I say he was my producer, he was my boss. He knew enough about my character and enough about what WWE was trying to achieve that he could get the best out of me in that environment, which is why we're sitting here today, because there's a level of trust and commitment and understanding and experience that goes along with all that. So thank you, Bruce.
Thank you.
It was a blast. For me, when I showed up at WWE, it was like, what the hell? This is going to be fun. You know, I had been at the bottom of
No. I don't mean the WWE. I mean what your legacy and what things you've done to help change the business to take it in new directions.
I don't know if you know my wife or not, but she's, you know, I've been with her for 33 years. Yeah. We've been together. And she's really smart. My wife is really, really freaking smart. And she's, and beautiful.
She is hot.
I'm overly achieved.
You are a bunch of bugger women.
I am way above my weight. But, you know, she taught me a long time ago, just live for the moment. Don't carry a bunch of baggage around. And that works both ways. I don't what's my legacy or what's the high points? And I don't worry about what's the low points. Here's my deal.
Weren't there signposts, places where decisions you made, case in point, what we talked about earlier, you were the first person to offer a guaranteed contract. And that altered how business was done.
But I don't think about it. I don't worry about it. I don't value it or devalue it.
But
we do,
and we're curious, are we not?
my legacy is, hopefully, here's what I hope my legacy is. Thinking about it now. Try new shit. Some of it worked, some of it didn't. Hopefully people remember the stuff that was good and forget the stuff that was bad. That's my legacy. Sorry, it's not any more exciting than that.
It's pretty general. Just leave it wide open. So in closing, try to sum up in some way the war for you, what it meant to how it played out for you in your life to this day?
Good question. It's a little awkward because as I try to move on, and I have, and I'm a great business partner in a production company and very successful in many different ways, I try to walk away from the wrestling business as much as I can, but I still love it. I still love this. It's still fun. So we wait.
Why do you still love it?
People. Right here. The people that I saw today. They're really passionate about this business. And the fact that I have one little bit of impact on that. It's kind of cool.
Bruce? Well, I'll sum it up with something that Eric kind of taught me. In. That, you know, I always took business very, very personal. And so when we talk about this whole thing, the war, I took the war very personally. He was trying to take my livelihood away from me. And when he came to work with us at WWE, my wife and I went out to Cave Creek and went for vacation. And where Eric lives, and we're sitting there, and my wife had never met Eric. The only thing that she knew of Eric was his persona and his character on Monday Nitro. So we're sitting at the bar, and Eric and Lori walk in, and she just looks and she goes, "I hated you." I mean, I just look at you now. I hate you. I don't know, but she hated that character. She hated what she perceived he put me through. And if anything, you taught me that so much, you don't take life too seriously, you don't take business too seriously or too personal. You take it seriously, but you don't take it too personal because a lot of times it's only business. And, you know, you kind of take that away from everything. And looking at, you know, this weekend, and hey, would we have liked to have had 500 people here? Yeah. But you have no idea also how humbling and how grateful it is to have you that showed up here tonight to listen to two old guys talk about the past. So, I mean, to that, I thank you guys. And I mean, it's great. And I mean, it's just so cool. And again, it's an humbling experience. And we're very appreciative. I know I am, and I know he is, because we sit there and talk about it. And thank you. I hope you enjoyed it.
You guys enjoy yourselves? Thank you all very much for coming. Spread the word. Tell everybody in the showroom that you can show up next time. We need to fill this room, okay? We have plenty.
Thank you guys very much.